Radio Prague News. There's been a sharp increase in the number of counterfeit brand name goods seized in the Czech Republic. The leaders of the two biggest Czech parties have held their first television debate since inconclusive elections 2 months ago. And a Czech soldier in Kosovo has most probably committed suicide. There's been a sharp increase in the number of counterfeit brand-name goods seized in the Czech Republic. In the first half of this year, the Czech Business Inspectorate confiscated over 600,000 counterfeit items, around the same figure for the whole of 2005, Bravo reported on Monday. The most common fake goods are clothing, footwear, cigarettes, alcohol, CDs and DVDs. Experts say that while in the past most counterfeit goods were imported from East Asia, production in illegal factories in the Czech Republic is now on the increase. The leaders of the two biggest Czech parties have held their first television debate since inconclusive elections 2 months ago. During Sunday's debate, Mirek Topolánek of the Civic Democrats, who came first in June's elections, called on Jiří Paroubek of the Social Democrats, who came second, to step down as prime minister. Mr. Paroubek refused, saying President Václav Klaus had already rejected one offer of resignation. The Social Democrats' chief said Mr. Topolánek was anxious because the period the president had given him to try to form a government was almost up. He said only negotiations between himself, the president, and Mr. Topolánek could resolve the crisis. The Civic Democrats' chairman has tried to form an alliance with the Christian Democrats and the Greens, but this coalition is one vote short of a majority in the Chamber of Deputies. A Czech soldier who was found dead in Kosovo most probably committed suicide. The 34-year-old military policeman was serving with the international KFOR mission. His body was discovered by a colleague at the Shaikovac military base on Sunday morning. So far, the Czech army's investigation into the cause of his death suggests the soldier had shot himself. Interior Minister František Bublan has praised the organization of the Czech Tech Free Techno Music Festival, which this year has been held on land rented from the Czech army in North Bohemia. Around 40,000 people from the Czech Republic and elsewhere in Europe have attended the festival, though about half that number left the site on Sunday evening. Last year, Mr. Bublan ordered around 1,000 riot police to break up the festival, following complaints from landowners. The record jackpot in the Czech Republic's biggest lottery, Sportka, was won on Sunday. Two winners share in the jackpot of 127.1 million Czech crowns, which is over 5.7 million US dollars. And a quick look at the weather. It should be quite sunny with rain in places over the next few days. Temperatures are expected to reach up to 30 degrees Celsius. This is the English service of Radio Prague. My name is Dita Asiedu. Up next, the annual Czech Tech was underway this weekend. How did the festival, which saw techno fans and police clash last year, turn out this year? We find out why the country's energy grid experienced its biggest blackout in the last 3 decades and our regular roundup of all the sports news. For years, the Czech Tech Music Festival was the source of certain controversy and for some apprehension. As an illegal techno festival, it attracted thousands to locations disclosed at the very last minute, most often in fields or meadows near unfortunate villages hit by a sudden surge of visitors and techno music from dusk till dawn. Last year, the situation reached a head when riot police intervened on fields in western Bohemia, and dozens of people, both officers and visitors, were injured. Television images of unarmed young people being beaten up caused a political storm. By comparison, this year's Czech Tech, which took place over the weekend, was a walk in the park. Jan Wellinger has the details.
Tic Tac may have enjoyed a less than glorious reputation with many in the past, but for thousands of techno fans, it has always been a cutting-edge event. Still, local property owners often complained their rights and property were being trampled on by countless uninvited guests, and damages often went into the tens of thousands of crowns. No more. After last year's clash with riot police who used truncheons, tear gas, and water cannons to bring the festival to a violent end, it was clear the situation could not be repeated. And it wasn't. On the initiative of the Defense Ministry, an appropriate location in North Bohemia, one that could handle the dusk till dawn onslaught of thousands of young people, was found by the Czech Army and rented to organizers. And that made a world of difference. Earlier, I spoke with 26-year-old Andrea Václavová, a first-time visitor from Prague, who described the atmosphere.
It was really great because everybody was very nice. The people were behaving really nice to each other, and I really enjoyed it. I was there with a group of people, and they were there for the third time, I think. I think it's quite a strange festival because you don't have to pay for anything, and I really like the idea that somebody says, where is it, and immediately 40,000 of people arrive. So I like this idea. For 2 days, it's great.
With so many people on hand, the event also went surprisingly smoothly. And after last year's oft-criticized intervention, police this time stayed outside the grounds and only helped with traffic or stepped in isolated cases. For example, to investigate petty crime and a reported rape. Otherwise, organizers can probably be quite happy. 40,000 visitors is a number that long-established Czech summer festivals can only envy. While perhaps not perfect, since some hardcore techno fans will grumble that Czech Tech in its new inception loses its original allure, namely its anti-establishment edge, the images from this year's dance party were certainly far more attractive than the view from the Czech Tech a year ago. And not surprisingly, when Czech Tech returns a year or so from now, many fans say they'll be back.
Jan Wellinger there, reporting on this weekend's Czech Tech Music Festival. Last week, the Czech Republic suffered its most serious power crisis in decades, which forced the Czech transmission grid operator to declare a state of emergency and announce limits on consumption. The crisis was completely solved in less than 24 hours, without the supply of energy being cut off anywhere in the country. On Monday, the Czech Republic's transmission system operator, ČEPS, called a special news conference to tell the public more about the events of last week. Pavla Horáková was there and is here with me now. Now, could you tell us, do we know what actually caused the crisis?
Well, Dita, it was actually a sequence of unforeseen events and accidents throughout Europe, not just here in the Czech Republic. And as the European energy market is very much interconnected, accidents in one part of Europe can affect the flow of energy elsewhere. First of all, the overall situation in Europe put a great demand on the capacity of the grids. The ongoing heat wave had made more and more people and companies turn on their air conditioning. And also some countries had to reduce production of energy because they had problems with the cooling at the power plants. And Germany, for instance, was forced to import more energy as its numerous wind power plants were not working because of the weather. There was no wind. And last but not least, the heat itself puts a great strain on the actual wires and cables through which the electrical current flows.
And in such a situation, I believe a small technical hitch can cause a chain reaction.
Quite, Dita, and ČEPS's Executive Director for Strategy and Finance, Miroslav Vrba, told me what the company believes the trigger was.
Došlo k atypickému otočení toku elektřiny oproti minulým dnům. To znamená, že...
On that day, there were unusual redirections of the flow of electricity in Europe. For example, the flow from Poland to Western Europe was reduced because Poland's plants were unable to export. And the flow from Slovenia and Austria to Italy was severed because of an accident there.
A Slovinsko do Itálie byly zablokovány neplánovaným vypnutím linek.
And that means that the Czech grid was used to bypass the problem spots, and all of a sudden the flow of electricity increased here in the Czech Republic. And one line in central Bohemia got overloaded and had to be disconnected from the grid. And that was followed by a fallen cable elsewhere, which meant that two elements of the system were knocked out and it started to snowball. Two areas in the Czech Republic had to be switched over to what's called island operation. That is, units continued to produce power, which was distributed locally, but the areas were isolated from the centralized network where maintenance work took place. And at that instant, the operator CEPS, in line with the energy law, declared a state of emergency and limited consumption of energy. But between 2:30 p.m. and 10 p.m, all the failures were fixed and the state of emergency was called off at 11 p.m. on Tuesday.
So what are the chances of this happening again? What has been learned from this crisis situation?
Well, CEPS say that they are happy that the legal measures they applied proved practical in a real-life situation, and they thanked consumers for sticking to the limits they announced. But what they say should be reviewed are the rules of the energy trade in Europe and exchange of information in real time. As far as enhancing the capacity of the Czech network, CEPS say this is not an issue because the bottlenecks, so to speak, of the European grid are not in the Czech Republic.
Thanks very much for that, Pavla. And I see that Ian Willoughby has just come in, which means time for our sports roundup.
Thanks, Dieter. First today is football, and the Czech league resumed after the summer break at the weekend. Last season's champions, Liberec, were quick out of the blocks, winning 2-0 over newly promoted Česká Budějovice, the latter featuring the most capped Czech player ever, Karel Poborský. After an awful 2005-2006 season for Sparta Prague, the country's richest club got off to a poor start this term, with a nil-all draw with Kladno, prompting fresh Sparta in crisis headlines. There have already been suggestions that coach Stanislav Gryga could be ejected from the hottest seat in Czech football. But one man who has cause to celebrate at the moment is Horst Siegel, who scored his 175th league goal for Must in their 2-0 draw with Jablonec. The former international is now 37 years old. Meanwhile, Jablonec's coach Petr Rada has been named as new assistant to Karel Brückner, manager of the Czech national side. Rada replaces Miroslav Beranek in the post. Further afield, Czech players made a very big impression on the first weekend of the new season in the Scottish Premier League. Jiří Jarošík scored on his league debut for defending champions Glasgow Celtic, while Libor Sionko did the same for Celtic's big rivals Rangers. And Roman Bednář and Michal Pospíšil were both on the score sheet for last season's runners-up Hearts. Their former teammate Rudolf Skatzel, meanwhile, has just signed a 4-year deal with Southampton in the English Championship. Moving on now, Czech javelin legend Jan Železný may have turned 40 last month, but he's still going strong. Last week, he came second at a meeting in Stockholm with a throw of 85.06 metres, some way short of his world record of 98.48 metres, but impressive nonetheless. If this fine form continues, Železný's in with a chance of reaching the podium at the European Championships in Gothenburg next week. Staying with the javelin, a new Czech women's record was set last week. Barbara Špatáková threw exactly 66 metres at a meeting in Finland, breaking the previous Czech best by 9 centimetres. Finally, Prague's Troja district on the banks of the river Vltava will be the centre of the canoeing and kayaking world from this coming Thursday. It's the venue for the 2006 Slalom Racing World Championships. Czech fans will be out in numbers cheering the country's best-known kayaker, two-time Olympic champion Štěpánka Hilgertová. But perhaps surprisingly, Hilgertová says the best way to watch the championships is on television. That's all the sport for today.
In case you've just tuned in, this is Radio Prague, the English service of Czech radio. In a moment, you'll have another chance to hear from the Czech-Canadian journalist Joe Schlesinger in One-on-One. But first, a quick note regarding three important frequency changes for those of you on the American continent. The following two frequencies have been in use since last Thursday. Listeners in the Caribbean area and the northern regions of South America can tune in every day from 9 to 9:27 a.m. UTC on 9955 kHz on the 31-meter bandwidth. Listeners in Central North America should tune in on 7385 kHz on the 41-meter bandwidth from 2 to 2:27 p.m. UTC. And finally, as of August the 1st, those of you in Central and Western North America can hear us on 5990 kHz on the 49-meter bandwidth between 3:30 and 3:57 a.m. UTC. Those were the frequency changes, and now it's time for one-on-one. It was first broadcast on March the 21st last year, and Jan Wellinger's guest then was Czech-Canadian journalist Joe Schlesinger.
In today's one-on-one, my guest is Joe Schlesinger, one of Canada's most respected journalists, who for years was top foreign correspondent for Canada's CBC, that is, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Originally from Czechoslovakia, Mr. Schlesinger returned to Prague in 1989 to report on the Velvet Revolution, a remarkable turn of events. As a boy, he had been sent out of the country to escape the Nazis. And after the war, he fled Czechoslovakia, soon after the country's communists assumed power. As a young man working in Prague for the AP, the Associated Press, Schlesinger saw the first arrests here and decided he would have to escape.
I spent 2 years in hospitals between 46 and 48, and by the time I came out of hospital, the communists had taken over. I was looking around for a job, and the only qualification I had is that I spoke English. So I got a job with the AP, and they started arresting people in the bureau. So that was the immediate impulse to leave. Whether I would have left without it, I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of people who had thought over the idea at the time but didn't do it because it was dangerous. The other thing is that I didn't have any family left. So there was nothing really to hold me in that sense. My network of friends had also disappeared. So I really had nobody.
The decision to finally leave?
The first attempt didn't work. I paid a guy who knew his way through Bratislava to Petrozelka on the other side of the Danube. We got across there, and we were just about to cross over when we ran. We could see a patrol with a dog coming, so we hid, and the dog didn't smell us. So we went back to town and couldn't cross that day. But I tried again in February 1950, and again we paid off somebody who knew the area, and there was a kind of a forbidden zone around the border. But somehow we had got a pass to go through to that zone, to go to Česká Velenice. And on the other side of the river, it's Gmünd in Austria. And I went with a girlfriend and walked along the river. This was still early on, so it wasn't as it was later on. But there were machine gun towers that we could see. And the river was frozen. And at some point, we just sort of ran across the river, dropped into a ditch on the other side. And we hadn't been seen by anybody in the tower. Because even if they hadn't gunned us down, this was the Russian zone, the Soviet zone of Austria, so they could have reported to the Russians, who would have picked us up. So that was it.
You could have stayed in Western Europe. How did the decision to come to Canada come about?
Oh, my brother was already in Canada. My brother had left in early 48, a couple of months after the communists took over. He left under some sort of scheme for Jewish war orphans coming to Canada, so my brother could get me a visa to Canada. Otherwise, you know, there was a possibility of going to Australia. I mean, there were possibilities. But if you were European, Australia seemed very far, far away.
And did you have any kind of preconception of what life in Canada might be like?
I don't know, but I had some surprises, you know. When I got to Vancouver, I remember what is now the Granville Street Bridge, which is a soaring concrete kind of thing that soars over False Creek. And it was a wooden bridge, low-level bridge, and the streetcars went over this, and every time some junk barge went through into this Falls Creek, the bridge would open and everything would stop, and I thought, my God, you know, I mean, the streetcars, too, were kind of wooden-sided, and, you know, in Prague, it was much more modern. to say nothing, I'd been in London, Paris, and God knows where else, and Vienna. And it just seemed that the New World was very old-fashioned.
You pursued studies in economics, but you had already been bitten by the journalist bug with your experience at the Associated Press, and you began writing for the university paper. What were some of the more important lessons that you learned in this period?
First of all, I wasn't bitten by the journalistic bug. That sort of came by accident. You know, I just wandered into the student newspaper, and before I knew it, I was the editor of it, so that sort of did that, I suppose. It was a student newspaper, so the tone was much lighter, and the Frosh Queen Festival at homecoming was important, and football games, and God knows what other entertainments, and it was kind of fun. It wasn't all about disasters and about coups and invasions and war.
Gradually you began considering a serious career in journalism. What was kind of the turning point?
Oh, well, the UBC was a student newspaper, but while I was doing that, I also got a night job at the Vancouver Sun on the police beat. So I covered all sorts of night police stuff, robberies and accidents and stuff like that. And I quickly realized that Vancouver, in the newspaper business that I was in, it was just too parochial. It was the end of the line in the news business. So I struck out for Toronto and got a job at the CBC for a while, then at the Maclean Hunter, then the Toronto Star. And journalists in those days in Canada went overseas for a couple of years. You went to London and you worked for either Reuters or UPI or something other. And then you came back. And so I went to London and got a job. Then I was offered a job at the Herald Tribune in Paris. Met my wife there. We got married. Our kids were born there. And I probably would have stayed there if it hadn't for the fact that Paris, while it was great, it's great for lovers. It's not so great for raising little kids. I moved back to Canada with my family, got a job at the CBC as foreign editor. Then within a few months, they came back to me and offered me the job of executive producer of The National, which was their main news program. So, and I became the head of CBC TV News, then decided news management was not what I wanted to do. And went abroad, went to Hong Kong, then to Paris, then to Washington, then to Berlin, you know.
How did you find, for instance, the transition from working in print to working in broadcasting?
I managed it. There's a great difference, but I started in television at the production end as an editor, not as a correspondent, not as a reporter. So I saw what reporters were doing. And I think I learned that way. So when I went out into the field, I guess I just took to it.
When you're covering a conflict, like in Vietnam, is there anything, any kind of school that can prepare you for that kind of reporting? I expect it's an experience like no other.
Yes, it is, but there are two things. One, I used to tell myself, you survived Hitler, you survived Stalin. The rest is sort of child's play after that. That was one thing. The other thing, I also realized when I was boss of CBC TV News, I had a young reporter named Bobby Scafino, and he wanted to go to Vietnam, and I said to him, Bobby, you're 29 years old. You have a wife and two kids, another one on the way. There's no way I'm going to send you to Vietnam to a war zone. So we sent him on some assignment to northern Ontario and in a small plane. And on the way back, they crashed and it killed him. And I decided, well, if you're going to die, you're going to die. And so off I went to Vietnam, even though I was married and I had two kids. You know, it just seemed to be you do what you have to do. And you follow your gut instincts.
I imagine as well that many of the stories that you covered and many of the people that you met, whether it was in Vietnam or in El Salvador or other places, that those stories have stayed with you.
Oh, yes, definitely. You know, you can go to whatever part of the world you want, whatever conflict you want, and you will see things that always seem to say the same, that there are losers and winners, and that the losers can suffer for no reason at all. And that the winners, well, there's a certain amount of common elements to all of them. The way they handle it, the way they handle themselves, the way they impose themselves, whether they're left or right.
What about moments of great historic importance? Gorbachev's reforms, perestroika, and glasnost?
You know, I was there when Gorbachev came to Washington. I was with Reagan in Moscow. And I was there in 1987. When Reagan was in Berlin and made a speech about tear down that wall, Mr. Gorbachev, And I remember thinking at the time, that's not likely to happen very soon. Of course, it did.
I was one of those many Canadians of Czech descent who watched you reporting from Prague on those heady days of the Velvet Revolution. What was it like for you to be there at that time, to experience something that you never thought would happen?
I think it was one of the great moments of my life. I had to leave the country twice. And in all that time, between the time I left in 39 and the time I came back in 89, Czechoslovakia had a rough, rough time. First the Nazis, then the communists. Finally, I was able to return and watch that era, that tyranny, the last of it vanish. It was a kind of a personal vindication.
Jan Wellinger's conversation with Czech-Canadian journalist Joe Schlesinger brings us to the end of the program. If you'd like to know more about the Czech Republic, our programs, or the Radio Prague team, visit our website www.radio.cz/English, where you'll find most of our reports transcribed and available in sound, both in MP3 and as a podcast. My name's Dita Asieru. Thanks for joining us. Goodbye.